welcome back to Observations. We're having a discussion with Roy Goodman about both the Big Bang, the creative event that began the universe, and its consistency with Yahweh's instructions, and its inconsistency with the science at the time that it was developed. And have moved to macroevolution and the likelihood that macroevolution is a valid idea. The first issue, of course, was that the idea of the extraordinarily improbable, and we'll consider how improbable it is in a moment, became probable with the passage of billions upon billions upon billions of years. But what we're discussing now is that that time did not exist for life to be conceived, and that Roy was, you were discussing this period about I guess what, say 3.8 billion years ago, about 700 billion years after the Earth was conceived, that we actually had liquid water, and how soon after that we had bacterium that was producing oxygen and cleansing our atmosphere of what was very caustic chemicals at the time.
That's correct. First of all, I should think that for those who don't understand what the terms are, macroevolution is simply called abiogenesis, or if you like, spontaneous generation of life from nothing. That's an important concept, I think. The bacteria developed very soon after the cometary bombardment finished, around about 3.8 billion years, or maybe even sooner than that, because Bargehorn, of course, may not have got the earliest rocks. At any rate, that would have given him something no more than 400 million years in which to develop life. Now, we can demonstrate further on that that is just way too short a period of time, just a blink in the geological past, and for life to have developed in all its complexity in that short period of time is impossible. But once it had been placed there by Yah developed the bacteria, he developed the genetic code that goes with it, and he set it away. And he's not a hands-on kind of guy. He set it running and, if you like, sat back to see how things went. Now, over the next 3 billion or so years, those
By the way, for those who think that's callous, it's the way it ought to be. And it's really the way it ought to be, is because if he did do it that way, if he micromanaged everything along the way, there's nothing to enjoy, there's nothing to see play out, there's nothing to learn, there's nothing to experience. If you're micromanaging and manipulating everything, it's so much more exciting to come up with the formula that has the potential to deliver all of these marvelous things and then enjoy the process.
That's right. And in fact, Yah developed the universe and, of course, our life to be indeterminate from the beginning.
Correct.
He knows what the end is, because in his past he can see our future.
Yes.
But he decided that he would allow us to have free will, and this is a bit of a sidetrack. To give us free will, the universe had to be indeterminate, because if it was a clockwork universe such as Newton suggested, then everything by definition is predetermined and there is no free will. So the form that we find the universe in is what you would expect of a God who provides us with free will. Anyway, back to the cyanobacteria. They fixed these poisonous gases in the atmosphere, turned them into chemistry in their own bodies, if you like, over billions of years, or within their own cells, should I say, over billions of years, and cleared the atmosphere so that we now have an oxygen-nitrogen atmosphere that is transparent. And that transparency now enables us to see clearly the sun. Because if you were standing somehow back on the Earth at the time that cyanobacteria were created, you would have been aware of light, but you wouldn't have been able to see where it was coming from.
Can I interrupt you here? Because there's just a profound tie-in here with the Bar Rashid, better known as Genesis, account. Because the atheist will say that it isn't credible, and their primary argument against the creative account saying it's not credible is that animal life was bacteria, if you will, plant life, not animal life. Plant life was conceived by Yahweh and developed over the third day, where it says, then on the fourth day, the sun and the moon became visible as signs. They have to be signs for the meetings that Yahweh had established. But that's exactly the way it occurred, isn't it? This form of animal life, of plant life, if you will, existed before the Earth's atmosphere was transparent.
Yes, that's right. But it was also the day, if you like, was a metaphor for the period or the time that was needed to clear the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. So once you could clear the atmosphere, then you can see the sun and you can see the moon.
Right.
And that will give you the signs.
Precisely in the order that it actually occurred, making a mockery of the argument against creation. I remember when I was writing my books on Islam, and I was trying to read up on what others had said. Almost everybody, to be even-handed, tried to discredit the creation account in the Torah by saying that it's stupid to say that the sun was created a day after plant life. But in fact, what it says is that the sun and the moon became visible. And in fact, that is the way it occurred, that plant life was conceived, and after plant life had an opportunity to flourish and to consume these, in many cases, these toxic materials, and as a byproduct, deliver oxygen into the atmosphere, the atmosphere became transparent.
That's exactly right. And when it was transparent, it was now time to start a new creation. And this is one of the times, I think, when Yah did intervene. I mean, it is certainly possible that he front-loaded the DNA from the very beginning for this to occur. But I suspect because of the short period of time in which all of the phyla appeared, in fact, he made the creation.
And we should be careful by saying that it's one thing, you were correct in saying that God does not micromanage. But it does not mean that he's an absentee landlord either. He does at times, at specific times, by his own declaration and by historical affirmation, there are very specific times where he does intervene in a very real way. And I think you're correct. I think this is one of those times.
Now, the Cambrian explosion occurred about 550 million years ago. There were some multicellular organisms called the Ediacaran fossils that occurred before then. They may in fact be actually joined in with the Cambrian explosion. But it occurred over a period of about 5 million years, which is really a geological blink in time. Now, if you actually then use the 6 days, 15 billion years analogy, you can actually work out that it would have taken, from Yah's perspective, 2.63 minutes. To actually develop the entire life forms that we find on Earth here.
And that's every life form that we know today. I mean, it's the basics of every known life form all came into existence in what would have been, from his perspective, a couple of minutes.
That's right.
And from our perspective, looking back, about 5 million years.
That's right. Yes.
But that 5 million years, to go from essentially plants to go to every type of animal in a 5 million year period completely undermines the time, solves the improbability of spontaneous generation of life.
Well, yes, I can go on to that if you like. I produced a protein when I was working in the laboratory. It was called apolipoprotein C1. Mm-hmm. It had just 57 amino acids in it. Now, amino acid is one of the basic building blocks of all proteins. Mm-hmm. There's more than 20, but we use 20 to build humans and most animals, in fact. Now, there are more unusual versions, but we can sort of ignore those. So you've got 20 amino acids that you require to build that 57 amino acid
Now, by the way, that protein, how did you go about building that protein? Because you didn't build it from scratch. You're a smart guy, but you aren't quite that. And you're creative, but you aren't quite that creative. Why don't you share how you went about developing and creating this protein, which you called C1?
Okay, we'll call it C1 for short. To build a protein, generally speaking, you require a bacterium or a virus of some kind. Usually mm-hmm. it's a bacterium, and one that's relatively safe to use. And the safest one is a thing called E. coli, mm-hmm. which is the name suggests you find in your gut. Mm-hmm. The E. coli will have a circular piece of DNA in it that we don't have, and it's called a plasmid. And the plasmid has got various genes on it. There's a switch to start things being transcribed and read. And what you can do is open that plasmid up. First of all, what you do is you destroy the organisms, separate out the plasmids, open the plasmid up, insert a DNA sequence that you have yourself made, and you can do that. It's only a very short sequence. So you can then insert that into the plasmid, then put the plasmid back into the cell. That's usually due to a process called electrophoresis. Then it goes back into the cell. Then you grow up the E. coli in a broth, and so that there's billions and billions of them, and now you've got billions of copies of your DNA, which the bacteria then expresses to form your protein. So that, in a nutshell, is how that was done. And then you break open the cells, and then you use special columns to separate out the protein that's yours, because there's a special thing like a bit of Velcro, if you like, that recognizes your protein only and discards all the others, and it sticks that protein on, and that purifies it so that now you've got your protein and you can identify it. So even with intelligent input, in some mm-hmm. way dispute the intelligence, but if you're with intelligent input, you can in fact do that sort of thing.
But you began with life.
I began with life.
You began with life in creating your protein. And your protein was relatively simple. I use that with tongue in cheek. It had 57 amino acids in sequence, correct?
Correct, yes. But the sequence is important as well. And from the point of view of the functionality, a protein, generally speaking, has a primary sequence. Mm-hmm. It has a secondary structure and a tertiary structure. Now, in the case of ApoC1, it didn't have a tertiary structure because it was so small. Mm-hmm. But your average protein will have a sequence that is very specific. You know, amino acid type 1 will go here, amino acid type 2 there, and so forth, all the way along the length. And the type of amino acid and the sequence of them tells the protein then how to fold thermodynamically into its lowest energy state. That means to say that it can then fold reliably, if you like. It likes to be in that position, so it's mm-hmm. thermodynamically at the lowest point. So what it does is it folds into what are called helices or alpha helices and beta pleated sheets and other things, and then when that's happened, then the whole thing folds into another form called the tertiary structure, which is usually the functional structure. For example, an enzyme may have, by that folding process, brought certain amino acids together into a cleft that enables the enzyme to work on two molecules, for example, to either bring them together or break them apart. The way that that's done, I won't go into the detail of it, but it's a very complex process, obviously, in doing so. But if you get the sequence of the protein wrong, mm-hmm. you won't get the right folding, and if you don't get the right folding, the resultant protein is useless. It doesn't work.
So just take your simple protein. For example, in our biology, we have 20 different amino acids. Most animal life has 20 different amino acids. And you just had 57 very, very simple protein. What are the odds, by chance, by random, that you would get those 20 proteins to assimilate in the proper order?
10 to the 57 it works out to be, but that's one chance in 10 to the 57. But can I backtrack a bit here?
Sure.
Because a lot of people don't understand what macroevolution is really telling us. Macroevolution says that on the Earth, early on, there was all of these organic molecules falling from the sky.
Uh-huh.
Now, they were falling from the sky because the fellow called Miller actually did an experiment in which he put what he thought was the original gases of the Earth into a reaction chamber, sparked them with an electric spark, and after a couple of weeks they found a sort of a brown sludge on the bottom of it, which when analysed turned out to be amino acids.
Mm-hmm.
Now that means that these amino acids in fact could have formed in that way in the Earth's primordial atmosphere. So, you know, open the champagne bottles, we've proved one part of the abiogenesis.
Yeah, but is an amino acid life?
No, of course not.
No.
What it really means is that these things just form readily if you have the right circumstances. In the same way that iron will rust if you put water and oxygen together with it.
Right.
I mean, it just simply does it.
Right.
These things will automatically appear, as a lot of other building blocks of life can be shown to appear as well.
Right.
So that experiment means that they were saying, okay, now there's all these amino acids falling into pools of water, and now they're sort of floating around there all by themselves. Now, the next thing is that just by happenstance, for example, a lightning bolt may come along and it hits a tryptophan molecule, which is one of the forms of amino acid, and it energizes it so that it then attaches itself to a phenylalanine and so on. So you get in other words, to get the sequence, it goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, up to 57, all joined up by these random processes.
It was pretty amazing. So not all, we'll acknowledge the fact that that once you have a second generation construct from a supernova explosion, and you have the elements available, and then you have the environment on Earth that evolved from that you will have amino acids. You would then need to have some force nudge them together, and not only get them to form together, but these different amino acids would have to be nudged somehow, lightning bolts, I guess, just striking without destroying them and putting them in proximity together in a very specific order.
That's right. The specific order would be, you have to have, for example, I think I've used in my example, what did I use? Serine, I think, it doesn't really matter. Amino acid one might be a serine. Okay, so you've got one in 20 ways you can pick serine out of a pool full of the 20
right.
amino acids.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first position you've got to fill. The second position might be a threonine, for example. Okay, so you've got another 20 ways of choosing that, and so on, all the way up to the 57. Now, the way that probability works is if you use the word and, for example, so you've got to have 1 and 2 and 3, then the chances of getting that one is going to be 1 divided by 20 by 20 by 20 all the way up to 57.
Right.
And that works out, if you do the maths, is 1 chance in 10 to the 74. That means it's 10 multiplied by itself 74 times.
You know, we as humans have a very difficult time with big numbers. And that is a rather stunning kind of a number. I mean, is there anything that you can share with our listeners that would help them understand what 1 in 10 to the 74th power of creating an extraordinarily simple protein would mean?
Yes, yes. The number of particles in the known universe is roughly of the same order, same magnitude. Roughly the same magnitude. So it's the whole of the universe has particles in it, which is roughly 10 to the 70, some 10 to the 80, something like that. That's the same probability as making even a small protein like that one. Now, if you go ahead and make a bigger protein, can you imagine the numbers involved? In fact, Fred Hoyle himself, if you like, kicked his own goal. He said there was a 1 in 10 to the 40,000 chance of making even the simplest bacterium. It was his calculation. And this is from an eminent scientist of his era.
10 to the 40,000th power. This is so astonishing in terms of the number that it's hard to fathom. It's hard for us to fathom the number of stars in the universe, with 100 billion stars in the average galaxy and over 100 billion galaxies that we know of. And that only represents about 6% of the universe. We can't even fathom that, but then think of these enormous stars and solar systems, each comprised of particles, and that we're talking about an astonishingly large number beyond the known particles in the universe. And by the way, with your simple protein, 10 to the 74th power, which is as many particles as there are in the entire known universe, roughly, that's just one very simple protein. It has no means to reproduce itself. It has no means. It has nothing to consume for food. It has no way to join with other proteins to create an animal life form. I mean, we are such a chasm at that point away.
Well, what's even worse is that the same UV radiation and lightning bolts that allegedly formed it in the first place also
yes.
worked to break it down.
Right. Almost immediately. Almost immediately.
That's
yes.
right.
Yeah.
I mean, the only number that's bigger than 10 to the 74 in the universe is the U.S. national debt.
And even as we talk about trillions of dollars, a trillion is a huge number. It's 10 to the 12.
That's right.
Right. And we're talking about here, for a simple protein, it gets you nowhere. I mean, it gets you nowhere because it's unrelated to anything else. It doesn't join with other proteins. It has no function. It can't reproduce. It can't grow. It can't do anything. Is 10 to the 74th. And to create a bacterium, I mean, a really, really simple form of life, according to Hoyle, was 10 to the 40,000th power.
Oh.
I mean, right. We're dealing with numbers that if you were to postulate a religion, which socialist secular humanism is formed on this postulate, and to say that I want you to believe that this unlikely event occurred, and it didn't occur once, it occurred many, 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 many times. And every time it occurred, it was victorious and lived and reproduced and then became more complex and thrived. What do you think the odds are that you could fool a world of people that something that 10 to the 40,000th power took place?
I think, unfortunately, it's fairly easy to fool most people because they have no concept of what these numbers mean.
Yeah, I guess so. And I think a lot of it, Roy, is something we've talked about in the past. And that's why I want you to... There's other issues here that we need to discuss. But one of the biggest challenges that we have when we talk about the fact that 10 to the 40,000th power for a very simple form of life, a bacterium, is improbable to the point of being laughably impossible to have occurred in the time that's available for it to occur and the medium for it to occur and then for it to go on beyond that, is that we have, over time, particularly with socialist secular humanism, we've dumbed people down to the point that they're not judgmental. They're not going to exercise good judgment regarding this information. And I think, Roy, that the basis of exercising good judgment really is probability. And if you pull probability out of people's thought processes, it becomes almost impossible for them to discern between truth and lies, between that which is possible and that which is not possible.
And the worst part about it is they don't want to know.
They don't want to know. Yeah, they don't even want to process it.
Yes.
But we're dealing with probabilities, and probability is the mother's milk of reason.
Yeah, a few people will respond. I've had a few people respond positively, and they've come back and questioned me, but I think that they've probably then gone away and spoken to a quote, expert, unquote, and then fallen by the wayside after that.
Yeah.
Because the expert would have been a macro-evolutionist, if you like, a social secular humanist, and they have agendas.
Absolutely. They have to sell this vision of faith, because what they're trying to get people to buy into is flat-out impossible. And not only is 10 to the 40,000th power impossible, you're still nowhere when you have the bacterium. You're just nowhere. Now, why don't we talk about the next challenges? Entropy, this tendency of things to go to disorder without outside input or direction. Because even if you'd created that first bacterium, then what?
Well, that's right. But can I just backtrack again for a second?
Please.
A moment. That comes back to the macroevolutionist idea of self-organizing molecules. They do occur. Self-organizing molecules, the idea behind, of course, self-organizing molecules is, for example, you can then form the bilipid layer of a cell wall spontaneously. Mm-hmm. And indeed you can. I mean, it's just like a soap mycelium, for example. All those little cloudy things you can see when you put soap into water. This little fatty grips with a charged sodium or potassium on the end pointing out to where the water is, and all the fatty bits are in the middle. So that self-organizes spontaneously into that. And in fact, that comes back to thermodynamics and the lowest energy potential. But you see, cell walls can form spontaneously, and that's they say, okay, we've got self-organizing molecules now. Why can't something like DNA and RNA and proteins self-organize? But, of course, self-organizing molecules are inherently low-information states. Mm-hmm. For example, if you have salt in water and you evaporate the water away, you'll get salt crystals.
Mm-hmm.
But the salt crystal is in the form of a lattice, as it's called. That means to say that each sodium chloride molecule is equidistant from every other one, and it forms the crystal. The thing is that each sodium chloride molecule is no different from everyone surrounding it, which means that if you want to take statistically again the way that you did my protein, you have to have one in the first position, a particular amino acid in the first position, a particular amino acid in the second, and so forth. With the self-organizing molecules, it doesn't matter which ones you take, because you end up with the same structure. So it's what's called a low information state, whereas the organic molecules such as DNA and proteins are very high information states. That is to say that the sequence of the thing is critically important. It's not just the fact that you've got these amino acids at millimole, you've got to have them in the right sequence to get the code correct, which then makes the thing work. Yes, no, sorry, if you want to continue on.
No, it's all beautifully stated that the examples that are used by the evangelicals for apologists for macroevolution will always cite something that they know themselves doesn't hold water. They know that their argument of self-organizing molecules and structures fails when you simply explain that, yes, very simple lattice structures will form, but we're talking about organic molecules, and with organic molecules, they are very high information. The order of things is essential, wherein the order is irrelevant.
Correct. That's right.
And they know this, by the way, but they'll deliberately preclude that information when making their argument.
Hmm. Now, the other thing, of course, that works against macroevolution is thermodynamics. The first law of thermodynamics is essentially the conservation of energy. That's a very basic principle of physics,
mm-hmm.
that you can neither create nor destroy energy. The second law of thermodynamics is a much more subtle one. What it says is that every time there's an energy transaction, that you lose energy, but you don't sort of lose it in the sense that it vanishes and never to be seen again. What happens is that the energy is degraded in its capacity to do work. It's what we call free energy.
Mm-hmm.
So that means that every time any kind of transaction occurs energetically, everything is continually losing energy. This is one of the reasons why the time arrow has to go in the forward direction, because you can't go backwards against the second law. A time is, after all, just events occurring one after the other. I mean, there's trillions of events occurring around you at every sort of second of the day. So that the the thermodynamic law requires that time goes forward. Also, quantum mechanics plays a role in that, but if we get time, we can talk about that later on. But the thing about this is that everything is tending to wind down. Your hot cup of coffee loses its energy.
Mm-hmm.
The way the energy is given off in this case is heat, which gets progressively longer and longer in wavelength. Mm-hmm. They can do less and less work until, in fact, they can do no work. Now, I suppose I should explain what that means. When you do any kind of work, the energy has to flow downhill. That means to say, and if you like, the work that it does as it flows downhill, a bit like water flowing down a mountainside,
mm-hmm.
is what you recognize as useful energy, that is, it's doing something. You eat food, for example, to make energy for your body, but a lot of that energy is lost as heat.
Roy will be back with that thought in a moment.